From the Sky News Centre at 5, holidaymakers have started arriving home from Tunisia, where a state of emergency has been declared. Human rights groups say at least 60 protesters have been killed in clashes with police during anti-government riots. Some travel companies have cancelled upcoming flights to the North African country and put extra ones on to bring customers back here. These people have just landed at Manchester Airport.
13 days early. So we only had 2 days whole holiday.
We didn't see no trouble whatsoever.
Disappointed, but with these things happening, it's sort of totally out of our hands, really.
Police have arrested a 14-year-old boy over the student protests in London. He's being questioned in connection with the throwing of a flaming object in Parliament Square on December the 9th. Nine men accused of plotting terrorist attacks on London's landmarks will stand trial next year. They were arrested in London, Stoke-on-Trent and Cardiff before Christmas and have been remanded in custody. The Prime Minister's sent a letter to the Brazilian President offering sympathy and support following the flooding there. Earlier, Prince Charles sent a message of support to those affected by the floods in Australia. Health professionals are urging caution over the latest study on breastfeeding. It suggests babies could be at an increased risk of suffering iron deficiencies and food allergies if they only receive breast milk for their first 6 months. But the World Health Organization guidelines say breast is best. Chief Executive of the National Childbirth Trust, Belinda Phipps, says it's best to get advice from your midwife or even other mums.
Groups of mothers getting together will compare notes, and you can see if somebody's got a baby a bit older than you, you can see what they're like if they're ready to feed, and compare it to yours and go, well, I don't think mine's quite ready yet. Talk amongst yourselves, because actually you're the most expert person in your baby.
A British judo expert has been awarded one of Japan's highest honours. 73-year-old George Kerr from Edinburgh has received the Order of the Rising Sun at a ceremony in the Scottish capital. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News, in association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
In Dorset, the A31 is closed. It's closed in both directions near Sturminster Marshall because of an accident involving a couple of vehicles. The road's closed between the Staggate Junction, the B3075 turning, and the B3074 Blandford Road. That takes in the Roundhouse roundabout, the A350 Junction. Beware very long delays in the area. If you're going west on the M4 past Bristol, traffic's looking heavy between junctions 19 and 20. That's the M32 and the M5 junctions. That's having a knock-on effect on traffic coming out of Bristol now on the M32, which is heavy between junction 1 at Hambrook and the M4 roundabout. In Wiltshire, if you're going west on the A36 from Salisbury towards Wilton, traffic's heavy between the Park Wall traffic lights and the A30 Wilton roundabout. And the A36 Wilton Road going into Salisbury, that's busy going towards the St Paul's roundabout. In Gloucestershire, northbound traffic on the A417 is busy going down the hill from Birdlip towards the Air Balloon roundabout. And if you're going north into Worcestershire on the M5, traffic's slow because of an earlier accident between junctions 8 and 7. That's the M50 and Worcester South. Traffic is taking about 30 minutes to get through those delays at the moment. And if you're going west on the M4 into South Wales, traffic slow through Newport on the approach to the Bryn Glas tunnels. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello, Bristol. And welcome to Friday Drive Time, BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, and I'm joined this week by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and on her way here is Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. After the 6 o'clock news, as Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance heads into 2011, we hear from National Vice President of the Civil Servants Union, PCS, John McAnally. How's he planning to fight the cuts, and has he done his sums right? Plus, an exclusive interview with former federal prosecutor John Loftus, who has a new book out called America's Nazi Secret. We'll be hearing from him about recently declassified information in the US on Britain's Royal Nazi agents. That's after six in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, dry but possibly windy. This weekend, highs of 11, wet on Saturday and Sunday with some gusty winds. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, fairly dry and sunny week, but feeling cooler, especially midweek. Next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of January, highs of 6 Celsius, so it's cooling down, dry and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now. Well, at least one of them. That's Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Now, first of all, I'm going to ask you this week about some of the hotspots around the world. And we're hearing this week quite a lot about Tunisia and Lebanon. We just heard in the news there about a state of emergency in Tunisia. So what's been going on? What's your take on it?
Well, in Tunisia, obviously, you've got a rebellion starting to develop amongst a younger generation, which has actually got no economic opportunities, and it's a big problem across North Africa, same in Algeria and Morocco. The Tunisian government is a pro-Western dictatorship, like many others that we don't hear anything about, except when things like this happen. Nobody's been making a fuss about them being run by undemocratic means for all these years, nor have they made a fuss about the Egyptians, for example, recently had an election in which the government got 98% and the opposition didn't get anybody elected at all, a sort of Saddam Hussein sort of election. Again, the West has nothing to say about it because these regimes are our allies. And if you cast back your mind back to the contested election in Iran and all the fuss that was made about that, and I'm not saying that a fuss shouldn't have been made, but there's a massive double standard at work here. When the regimes are our allies, we backpedal. When they're our enemies, we pile on the pressure and accuse them of all sorts of things. So that would be my take on Tunisia. And a lot of these regimes are actually very fragile because of the economic crisis. It's economics that are driving the riots in Tunisia. People can't get jobs. It started when a student who got a degree who was selling stuff on the side of the road to make money, he was ordered that he was refused a permit to do that. So he set himself on fire, burned himself to death, and started a mass movement amongst young people against the regime. And of course, we've had similar experiences in the sense of young people taking to the streets against a regime not a million miles from here, haven't we? Lebanon is a rather different situation. The Hezbollah has withdrawn its support from the unity government because of the Hariri Tribunal, which is basically a Western-backed judicial institution, which is going to try to pin the blame for the assassination of the Prime Minister of Lebanon, Rafiq Hariri, a couple of years ago, onto Hezbollah. Hezbollah claimed that they didn't do it. There's a potential for civil war to break out in Lebanon. The Israeli army is on full alert. People have got to remember that the possibility of war in the Middle East is always there.
Now, I seem to remember when Rafiq Hariri was assassinated that it was a massive explosion, and actually it was very, very difficult to tell who'd done it.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what Hezbollah says, that in actual fact, they've had press conferences in the last year where they've brought forward evidence suggesting that it was the Israelis. And at one stage, this tribunal, which was set up basically under pressure from the Americans, was originally going to accuse the Syrians, and four Lebanese generals were held for several years on complicity with the murder, presuming that they'd been working with the Syrians, but it all turned out the evidence had been fabricated. So lots of people in Lebanon do not accept the legitimacy of the tribunal. There was a deal being done behind the scenes to kind of keep everybody happy, but the Americans went in with hobnailed boots and kicked that one into touch last week. But the danger is, of course, that Lebanon could go back to war, and that would be extremely destabilising for the whole region.
Now, going back to Tunisia for a minute, most people think of this as a sort of nice, cosy holiday destination, and now it's being told at the last minute by the Foreign Office.
Do you remember that old Sex Pistols song that used to go, "Cheap holidays and other people's misery"? I think that is one of the problems we have, is that people can take budget holidays in places like this and say what a nice place it is, but you can't see what's going on behind the scenes. And these, basically a lot of these regimes in the Middle East, which, I mean, Tunisia was very safe for Western tourists because it's a very pro-Western regime. Democratic, though, it is not. It simply isn't.
OK, well, let's go and have a look at some of the other stories this week after a little look around the world there, a sort of this week's hotspots. And we're here today that Kenneth Clark, the Justice Secretary, has been warned about the riot prison. This is Ford Open Prison, and the Independent Monitoring Board from Ford Open Prison has reported that in the last 3 years since the introduction of a dog handler with two dogs, a large amount of contraband has been discovered, including 360 mobile phones, 323 chargers, 115 SIM cards, 1,200 pounds worth of cash, 200 items of drug paraphernalia, 11 parcels and 51 litres of alcohol. And a few weeks before the riot, Ken Clark, the Justice Secretary, was warned that something needed to be done about this prison. And as we heard, of course, when the riots took place over Christmas, there were only two staff looking after thousands of inmates.
Well, yes. I mean, it's hard to... I mean, obviously, an incident like this needs to be properly investigated in every respect. It's easy to jump to conclusions from a distance, but the fact there's only two staff on duty in a prison of possibly hundreds of people...
Actually, yes, I mean, I said thousands there. It's actually 500 inmates, not 1,000.
Yeah, but you've still got two people are going to find it quite difficult to control 500 inmates, aren't they? We've seen this in the US where they have privatised prisons where there's virtually 24-hour lockdown. They're cheaper because somebody just sits at a CCTV console and watches people, and that's all that happens. And once you've lost control, you've lost control. I mean, the costs of losing control are greater than having the staff there to deal with the situation in the first place. And that's why prisons are expensive, and that's why Ken Clark, to his credit, is trying to send less people to prison, although many people in his party aren't very happy with that.
Well, why aren't they?
Because there's a knee-jerk reaction amongst conservative supporters and, I suppose, in the general population that prison is somehow a good thing, and people being sent to prison is a good thing.
Well, it is if people are a danger to society.
Indeed.
And many of these inmates at Ford are long-term prisoners.
Lots of
prisoners.
People are being sent to prison in Britain who wouldn't be sent to prison in other countries. And we've actually doubled, I think, our prison numbers in the last 20 years. And I think this is to do with populist approaches. You know,
well, what sort of people are being sent to prison in Britain that aren't elsewhere then?
Essentially non-violent offenders. I mean, elsewhere, say in the Netherlands, the people who go to prison are people who deal in violence. Those are the people that you need to be protected from. Petty criminals of all kinds are a nuisance, but prison is not the answer for those people.
But most of these people at Ford are long-term prisoners who are there specifically to get them ready to be released.
Well, I wouldn't like to comment particularly on this particular incident. I think it's something... When an incident like this happens, you've got to get all the facts. And presumably there will be some inquiry, internal or otherwise, into what happened and why it happened. But the staffing level doesn't sound right, just at an initial... on New Year's Eve, they're all fired up, it's an open prison, so they're actually sneaking alcohol in, and you've only got two people on duty.
Our next story, then. Romania's witches are hexing the politicians in Romania for cursing the financial... they're causing, apparently, the politicians the financial disaster. Every week, Max Kaiser goes to the heart of the scandal behind the financial news headlines on Russia Today. So let's have a listen to him now.
Hi, I'm Max Kaiser. This is the Kaiser Report. I put a hex on you! I put a hex on you! Stacey Herbert, tell me more.
Max, Romania's witches curse income tax ruling. So because of the financial crisis and the collapse of banking systems and GDPs around the world, Romania's government has started taxing witches and fortune tellers from the 1st of January this year. And because of this, the witches are basically cursing the government. Now, Queen Witch Bratura Buzea is furious about the new law, and she says that she plans to cast a spell using a particularly effective concoction of cat excrement and a dead dog. This is her reasoning for it. We do harm to those who harm us. They want to take the country out of the crisis using us. They should get us out of the crisis because they brought us into it. And I might add, they brought us into it, the global banking cartel, through what could be called just as wacky as using cat excrement and dead dogs that they stuff into a concoction of some sort of securitized product.
Yeah, well, the Goldman Sachs collateralized debt obligation, most of it is cat excrement and dead dogs. This is what they're finding. The Federal Reserve balance sheet in Washington, the reason why they're afraid to do an audit at the request of Ron Paul is because they know that they've got basically dead beetles, eye of newt, some old chicken bones, some dead cat excrement. That's about all they got at the Federal Reserve because the U.S. is technically bankrupt, bankrupt, insolvent.
So these witches are fighting fire with fire.
That was Stacey Herbert, Max Herbert, Max Kaiser there speaking earlier this week. Martin, is Max right there when he's saying that actually these collateralized debt obligations and various other tools that the investment banks have been trading are really, as he was saying there, cat excrement and rubbish, basically?
Yeah, I mean, that is the serious meat of what is a light-hearted piece. That is the fact. What's been happening in the US is that it's now becoming clear that many of the mortgage foreclosures are illegal. The banks are trying to foreclose on mortgages and the courts are beginning to throw it out and saying, actually, you haven't got the necessary paperwork to prove that you own the buildings that you are repossessing. That may sound like good news, and in a way it is for the people being repossessed. The problem is that it means that the banks really are insolvent, and most of what they are sitting on, I mean, the banks in Britain are supposedly making a profit and just pay themselves a big bonus. Perhaps we'll come to that in a minute, but these profits are all based upon these collateralized debt obligations and structured investment vehicles being worth what they claim they are worth, and in actual fact they're worth quite possibly nothing at all, which means that the banks are absolutely hollowed out.
What about this audit of the Fed, that's the Federal Reserve Bank that he was talking about there? Someone called Ron Paul has been calling for an audit of the bank.
Yeah, it's Ron Paul, who's a right-wing libertarian congressman, but he's also teamed up with Bernie Sanders, who's the only socialist in the Congress. So it's sort of radical right, radical left getting together to say, let's have a look at the books of the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve are fighting this tooth and nail because basically they've been handing out taxpayer money hand over fist to their chums in Wall Street, and they don't want people to know about it. I mean, basically what the Federal Reserve is saying, the money we've given away is commercially confidential and we can't let people know who's had what. And obviously Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders aren't happy with that.
Well, Bativa Busaya and the other Romanian witches are going for the government here. Are they going for the right target, or should they be going for the bankers?
The Romanian government are pretty low in the international pecking order. I mean, from what I remember of the Romanian government, they're quite gangsterish, but then that doesn't make them that different from many other governments around the world. The politicians, essentially, are the monkey, the banks are the organ grinder. And what people are finding out all over the world is that politicians are absolutely useless and incapable of protecting them against the financial predators that are out there.
Well, for anyone that watches Russia Today on Freeview or any of the other Freeview channels, just to let you know that although I hadn't seen it on any of the other media, mainstream media around here, there's been a big reboot of the Mendip Freeview mask this week, around about Wednesday, I think, or maybe no, actually, 2 p.m. on Tuesday, the 11th of January. That's the Tuesday just gone. If you're having trouble with your digital television, it's not you, it's the mast. And what you have to do is basically switch off your Freeview box and then get it to search for all the channels all over again. And that happened this Tuesday. I had to actually search all around the internet and finally found something in the Gloucester Citizen saying that there were some people around the Gloucester area that actually get their television from Mendip. But actually this mast, Mendip mast, serves something like 720,000 households. But I hadn't heard anything about that. I mean, maybe some people have mentioned it. So if you're having problems with Freeview, that's why. And if you have elderly friends, neighbours, please do let them know, because quite often the older people find it very difficult to cope with these, the modern digital technology, which I must say I kind of long for the analogue days back again. Another story this week, Martin. Activists challenge convictions in wake of police spy revelations. And this is what we heard on Monday, that there had been a police spy in amongst the climate activists. Now, is this any real surprise?
No, not really. What I think is raising eyebrows is the actions of these infiltrators. The guy has come clean. Kennedy was actually having sex with various activists and pretending to be an activist.
That just part of his cover?
I think that breaks police guidelines, frankly. I think that's the issue there.
Which police guidelines? Because we're constantly hearing that the Home Office issues guidelines, Association of Chief Police Officers
does. The police are supposedly accountable ultimately for their actions, even when they're engaged in infiltration operations.
But they will say often that ACPO issues guidelines and we stick to those, not the Home Office ones.
Well, the point is that there are no guidelines that allow you to use sexual favours as a means of infiltration, not as a police officer anyway. If you're working for the intelligence services, of course, you can do what you like because there's no rules. And that's another question. I mean, a lot of this stuff has come out through over 30 years during the Irish conflict. Informers, the use of informers and so on has been pretty comprehensively questioned there. Activists simply have to be aware that the state does take an interest in their activities, although in this particular case I think it's actually private companies. There's now a kind of private spying network beginning to develop where private companies buy in expertise from serving and ex-police officers and security service people, and that's a bit more worrying because it's not accountable in any way. If you remember, in the past they had the economic lead had a blacklist of trade union activists, which was basically cleaned from MI5 and Special Branch and then used by employers to discriminate against people they didn't want to employ. I think what you've got to remember is also that taxpayers are paying for this, and as long as you're engaged in legitimate protest, is it fair for your taxes to be used to frustrate what you're trying to do, especially if what you're trying to do isn't actually illegal in the first place?
Yes, but this trial hasn't actually gone ahead, has it? But
no.
However, last month, in a separate trial, 20 Green campaigners were convicted of conspiracy to commit aggravated trespass during the same protest after failing to convince a jury their actions were designed to prevent immediate harm to human life and property from climate change. The police allowed this trial, unlike the later one, to run all the way to conviction, said Mike Schwartz, whose firm Bindmans represents both groups of protesters. In the light of events last week, this must be seen as a potential miscarriage of justice.
Well, yes, I mean, the police have to be very careful in the methods that they use, because if it comes to trial and they haven't used correct methodology, then it's going to be thrown out by the judge and the jury, and it should be. And people have got a right to expect that their right to legitimate protest is going to be protected, and that the police are not there as an arm of big capital and the state to keep people in line. Now, the police may think that is their job, but they must really consider whether that is their job. It's because the danger is, if the police are seen to be behaving in this way, then the confidence in them that we need to have if we're going to combat, for example, terrorism, will not be there. And that will be a loss to us all.
Well, certainly it looks as if, on the face of it anyway, as if without this particular protester, the protest may not have even happened.
Indeed, it looks as if it may be entrapment. A very famous case of entrapment was the first bomb attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, where it turned out that the whole plot was actually created by the FBI, and there have been many since then which have turned out to be entirely created by the FBI. What was particularly shocking about the 1993 attack is that six people died in the bomb that was let off in the World Trade Center, but the FBI knew all about it all along and had even designed the plot, including the final denouement, which allowed the bomb to go off and six people to die. That is entrapment. Entrapment is wrong in principle, and also, of course, begins to make people begin to feel that the state itself is potentially a terrorist organisation.
Well, it's a bit worrying to think that potentially undercover police officers could have been involved in lots of these cases where people have been entrapped, and actually no one has ever found out that it was a police spy.
Well, indeed, although in several of these FBI cases in the US, including the 1993 bombing, came to trial, and it's quite obvious from the trial transcripts that it was an FBI plot. In my view, the jury in that trial should not have convicted and should have begun the possibility of prosecuting the people who organised the plot, who were all inside the FBI. Now, this is not conspiracy theory. This is historical fact, and this is what people have got to remember. The Western states, the US, Britain, have been engaged in provocative terrorist acts where they have created the terrorism and then said, oh, look, we've got some terrorism over here. People should be very suspicious about all of this.
Now, Barclays' American-accented boss, Bob Diamond, rarely appears on TV or anywhere public unless he has to. And when he does, he gets a drubbing, as he did at Monday's sitting of the Treasury Select Committee. Quizzing him was Tory MP Dave Ruffley.
May I answer? We are very grateful to the central banks around the world, to the governments around the world, for the actions that they took.
No, I'm talking about the British government, who stand in the shoes of the British public. They say and this is accepted, that you're too big to fail. And the taxpayer stands behind you. That makes you more creditworthy. It means you can borrow much more cheaply than if you're a standalone organisation. Now, what I'm asking you, Mr. Diamond, is are you grateful to the British public?
Can I ask you one question?
Can you answer that question?
I
ask the questions, you give the answers. Okay.
But you...
Are you grateful to the British public?
Part of what you said...
Are you grateful to the British public?
We are very grateful to the central banks. We're very grateful to everyone. We're very grateful to everyone that has helped the financial system get
the British taxpayer
back. We're thankful for everyone.
Will you resign? Make yourself accountable by promising to resign now today if you do not significantly increase lending in the coming year so that Britain can grow and British economies can borrow on sensible terms.
Well, we're... We can't...
It's a yes or no, because the chairman wants a quick answer to this.
Well,
no?
That was Tory MP Dave Ruffley quizzing boss of Barclays Bob Diamond on Monday's sitting of the Treasury Select Committee. He's really kind of refusing to thank the British taxpayer. Does that really mean anything, Martin? I mean, you can't really expect him to be thanking the taxpayers, can you?
Well, I think that the kind of tone that was being adopted there by his questioner was justified, but it's political grandstanding.
But you're just saying that because he's a Tory, aren't you?
I am saying that because he's a Tory. It's true, because in actual fact, to be honest with you, if a Labour MP had done the same, it would be political grandstanding, because they've got no power to influence the situation.
They've got no power, but they own, surely, we own a majority of many of these, not Barclays.
What I'm saying, a Labour MP has got no power to influence the situation because they're not in power. I quite like the tone of voice from that Conservative gentleman there, Dave Ruffley, gold star to him, but rhetoric is cheap and actions are much more serious. Bob Diamond is a classic example of somebody who is totally oblivious to the damage that the banks have done. And when people talk about how much money the banks bring in, and we've got to actually keep them and we don't want to lose the banking industry in Britain and so on, I feel like saying, well, they've already cost us £1 trillion. How much more are they going to cost us before we realise that the private banking system is too expensive for us to run it anymore and we'll have to change it? I think that will only happen when we've gone through the next phase of the crash and the crisis. Then people will realise that the private banking system really is finished for good.
Well, I think it was Tuesday this week in the Daily Mail, it was more made very clear, because we were told, back off our bonuses and then we'll lend, say the banks. Downing Street admitted defeat in its battle to stop banks paying huge bonuses to their staff. Dictating the size of individual bankers' payments or overall bonus pools was not possible, said officials.
Well, I think it's just typical of the kid gloves approach to this whole issue. I mean, don't forget, the banks are not going to lend into an economy which is being deflated by the government. Nobody wants to borrow money much at the moment because there's no demand in the economy.
Well, there are a lot of people, particularly small businesses, that want to borrow money.
No, in actual fact, the banks are quite right to point out that hardly anybody wants to borrow in these circumstances. And the more the government deflates the economy through spending cuts, the less they will want to borrow.
Well, that hasn't really kicked in yet, though, has it? No, I mean, there are many businesses out there.
But investments are made in advance, aren't they? You invest in hope of demand that will be coming up in the future.
What we're hearing, though, is that many small businesses that already have loans, I mean, if just take your point for a moment, which I don't, but we'll do that. But they're finding that these loans are being renegotiated upwards. They're having to pay more interest on the money they've already got.
What we're actually doing at the moment with 0.5% interest rates, and the Bank of England kept them at 0.5% this week, is we are basically lending to the banks at 0.5%, and they are lending on to others at 5%. That's very easy money if you can get it. I mean, anybody can make money doing that. You don't have to be a genius to make money in that situation. The whole fallacy is that by lending money to the banks, they will then lend it on to others. The government should cut out the middleman, basically wind down the private banking system and use its own resources to reboot the economy.
Yes, but who's more powerful, the government or the private banking system?
Well, we know the answer to that. And don't forget why that is. It's because ultimately politics is paid for by the wealthy, both here and in the United States of America. The only change to that pattern on the horizon is the trade union funding for the Labour Party in Britain. In Scandinavia, all politics is funded by the state and businesses are kept at arm's length. But we've got a situation in the US where Wall Street effectively bankrolls both parties and therefore they decide the policy, even though they're bankrolling both parties with taxpayers' money. It becomes a protection racket between the politicians and the bankers against the taxpayers.
Next story, the poor have been charged £1,300 a year more by firms, say Save the Children. Poor families being charged about £1,300 a year more for basic goods and services, a report reveals today. Power bills are nearly 30% higher because the less well-off tend to use prepayment meters instead of direct debit. They pay up to three times the real price for items such as cookers by getting them on hire purchase. And insurance is also dearer as they live in high crime areas, the Save the Children found. Their financial expert Martin Lewis, who helped compile the study, said that it's ridiculous but true, it costs more to be poor.
Well, I mean, this is the way the private sector operates. The risks are greater, the poor always pay more, which is why, coming back to what I was saying earlier, you might want to have a banking system which is run as a public utility rather than for private profit, and then that might also go for things like gas and electricity as well, in which case you could pursue social goals like, for example, equalising the amount that people pay, because that's a social goal that you could give publicly owned institutions. The private sector is all about rip-off. That's what it's about.
Okay, next story. Credit cards have been used to pay the mortgage or rent by 2 million people in Britain. This is research by Shelter, the homeless charity, and it shows that millions are using credit cards in a last-ditch attempt to keep a roof over their heads. And this total is now up to 2 million people, according to The Guardian. And Shelter, they've used their credit cards to pay the mortgage or rent, an increase of 50% in 1 year. That is, I imagine, my maths is right, that's 1 million people last year, 2 million this year, according to the housing and homelessness charity Shelter. It was conducted the research in August last year and found that 6% of the 2,200 people questioned had used credit cards to meet their housing costs in the previous 12 months.
Well, these are all signs on the horizon that the government's economic policy isn't going to work. If people are doing that using credit cards, which has a much higher rate of
interest. But this is all great for the banks, isn't it?
Oh, yes, that's why people see that the financial sector is looting the economy. They are drawing massive bonuses. The shareholders are being paid off. And who are the shareholders? Oh, they'll be the millionaires. They'll be the Osbournes and the Camerons, because they're both millionaires, of course. And, of course, they will be making money on the back of this. Other people will be losing money. But it's not the problem is that the economy will not recover while we allow this parasitic financial sector to operate in the way that it's operating. And by the end of this year, we're going to see ordinary people waking up to what the fact that they've been had.
Campbell Robb, the chief executive of Shelter, said this research brings into sharp focus how keeping a roof over your head has become a daily struggle for millions across the country. It's a totally unsustainable situation and one which we fear could see thousands more families pushed into the spiral of debt, eviction, repossession and ultimately homelessness, which we'll be talking about later. Using credit cards to pay the rent or mortgage is simply robbing Peter to pay Paul. With the average credit card interest rate now standing at over 16%, it's the worst possible course of action. Already, someone faces the nightmare of losing their home every 2 minutes in Britain. And we would urge every single one of these people now relying on credit to keep their home to seek advice urgently. And I suppose that's something like the Citizen Advice Bureau.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the debt advice sector, and I used to work briefly in it 2 years ago, as you know, Tony, the debt advice sector is not actually geared up to deal with the scale of the crisis. If I were the Chancellor of the Exchequer, one of the things I would be doing is massively increasing the debt advice sector to try and mop up all of these people and help them to resolve their debt problems. And of course, the way to help people resolve their debt problems is often to let them go bankrupt and so on, and for the debts to be written off. And of course, if the debts are written off, as we saw in the US with the foreclosure crisis and the banks not actually owning the properties they're trying to repossess, the problem with that is that it really does mean the banks are bust. And we're all going round the houses refusing to face up to the fact that the banks are bust. So coming back to the bonuses, absolutely unacceptable. The banks are bust. They shouldn't be paying bonuses. They should all be getting their P45s.
But surely the banks are much more likely to be bust if we do what you say and forgive these and forget this debt.
Yeah, but that's because we have to bust the banks. That's what has to happen. That's what's going to happen. We either do it in an orderly fashion or it will happen in a disorderly fashion. But one way or the other, they will have to go.
Okay, onto the Joe Yates murder story. And Marina Morris is joining us to look at violence in Bristol.
Hello. According to the regional snapshot for crime published by the Office of National Statistics for 2009-10, the Southwest region had the second highest incidence of the violent crime against a person for any region. This 586 incident per 10,000 in the population. This 3.1% of the population suffering as a victim at least once. These statistics were exceeded only by Scotland at 622 and compared to the English average of 469 incident per 10,000 in the population. These statistics were generated by responses to the National Crime Survey on households, chosen at random and would include unrecorded crime. However, if you look at the recorded crime statistic for the same area and period, there were 139 violent crimes against the person per 10,000 in the population. About a quarter of the statistic just quoted, and one of the lowest statistics in the UK. The differences in these two statistics could in part be explained by problems with statistical sampling, but could also indicate that a vast amount of violent crime is going unreported throughout the region. If we only consider reported crime, the city of Bristol had the highest incident of violent offences against the person at 27 per 1,000 of population, almost double the average for the southwest region of 13.9. This statistic can be influenced by a transient population who work but don't live in the city. This factor probably goes a long way to explain the highest national score of the City of London at 70.4 per 1,000. According to the Avon and Somerset Police's website for violent crime mapping, most of the regions has average level of this crime, with only the Cabot and Clifton neighbourhood area recording as a high. Between 2009-10, violent crime in this area rose by 15%. At March 2009, there were 11,023 police officers on ordinary duty in the southwest area, or one per 473 of the population. This compares with a national average of one per 377 people. Nationally, the Police Federation expects 20,000 police officers to lose their jobs over the next 3 to 4 years, based on the information from forces. Avon and Somerset Police will need to make saving of £40 million over the next 4 years after the budget was slashed by the Home Office as part of the government's cuts package.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Martin, maybe you can throw some light on why it is that, I mean, OK, so we're something like a quarter as much violence going on here as in London, but why is it that the cities are so much more violent than the countryside?
Well, it's partly to do with statistical sampling, as Marina pointed out. I mean, it's reported crime, don't forget, that we're talking about here. But don't forget, pockets of deprivation in inner London and inner city Bristol are as high as anywhere in the country, and we all know that crime and deprivation go together.
So less deprivation in the countryside?
Well, no, there is deprivation, but what you have is poverty becomes mixed up with other social problems in cities. In the countryside, there's less scope for violent disorder, for example, because there's just less people. And I think that, yeah, I'm not. Ultimately, Bristol, as we know, is not actually terribly violent as a city. If you've been attacked, of course, it doesn't seem like that. And of course, the tragedy of this murder brings home that any act of violence can be extremely unpleasant for those who are on the receiving end of it.
Well, you supposedly live in Stapleton Road, which is supposed to be one of the most violent parts of the city.
Yes, and there was a lad killed at the end of my road last year. But these kind of things can happen. Crime is driven, a lot of crime is driven by the drugs industry, as we know, and as I've argued on this programme many a time, the drugs laws actually create a field day for crime. They need to be looked at, and we need to basically have a fairer society with more chances for people.
Well, Marina has not just done our report on violent crime, she's also been out on the streets this week to find out how worried you are about walking around, particularly in Clifton, late at night, since we heard the street lighting in Joe Yates Street up in Clifton was well below the standard, and the council are now planning to upgrade it.
Following the recent murder of Joanna Yates, are the streets a safe place for women at night?
Yes, because the police are doing all they can. Most women are more sensible than that, and they don't go out at night. It seems more sensible.
Round here, normally, I think so, yeah, yeah. And there's quite a big police presence at the minute, so not late at night, but early evening I'd say is safe, yeah.
I think they are safe, but I think a lot of people are nervous about being out alone. It's difficult to tell. I mean, you still see lots of people out shopping, so people are getting out. My wife certainly feels a little bit less sure about being on the streets alone.
I think so, yes. Obviously, it was a horrible and sad event, and we were away at the time, but we saw it on the news every day where we were staying on holiday. Very, very sad about it. But people should not get over-concerned about these things, because I know that 100 years ago or more, the streets were much more dangerous than they are now. And the media bring these to everyone's attention, and people get very excited about it and very upset. But I think the reality is the streets are still safe.
My husband warned me not to go out during the night time, so...
I live in Bristol. I work in Clifton most of the time. I would have thought so. They seem pretty safe to me, anyway. I've never had any problems.
Yes, I think so.
I think they are, actually. This is just a one-off occasion, I think, and I think women are very aware of what they need to do to walk around the streets at night.
Have you changed your behaviour?
A little, but only I don't go quite so far with the dog. But I have a dog, so I don't feel quite so vulnerable, perhaps, as people on their own.
Yeah, look over my shoulder more, so I'm looking behind me more than I ever used to before. I feel more uneasy in the dark on the streets, yeah.
Not really. I haven't changed my behaviour, but my wife certainly wouldn't be walking home late at night alone at the moment. She'd want to go accompanied.
No, not at all.
Yes, because I have a baby, I need to stay during the night time with my baby. So, but I'm afraid of going out. It is. I have the kind of feeling, yeah, so it is.
I haven't personally, but I know people have. You know, they won't let us into properties unless they know who we are and things like that, you know.
Not really, a bit more aware, that's all, but no real change.
Are the police doing enough to find her killer?
I think they're doing all they can. They're working terribly hard. It's very difficult. Everybody speculates. We all wonder, you know, we all chat about it. There's not a lot else to talk about at the moment, which is very sad. But now there's this trouble in Brisbane. I think that might take over from the news, which is good in a way. But I hope they find him, or her, or whoever it is. I think we'll all be happier when they do.
I don't think it's up to me to comment on that, but there is a large police presence in the area, yeah. More than that there was before.
Very difficult to know. I don't think they've got much to go on. I have faith in them. It's difficult to answer that question. It's difficult to know how much they actually know. What more can the police do? The case has become quite low profile again. You know, maybe they could relaunch, you know, some of the publicity surrounding the campaign, or maybe the police are playing a strategic game here and only releasing small amounts of information. But I think they could keep it publicised a little bit more at the moment.
I hope they are, but I'm not on the inside track there, but I certainly hope so. I hope that all this CCTV will throw up some important clues.
But I think her friends was asking more investigations by police recently.
I think they're doing all they can, to be honest with you. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, really. I think probably I think generally we should have a DNA bank so that everybody, when they're born, gets a DNA taken, and then there wouldn't be any of this.
I'm sure they are. But, of course, the press always want more information, but they're not going to get it from the police whilst they work in the case.
Should the council be considering turning off or dimming the street lights?
No, definitely not. I think we need street lighting, particularly just now. Everybody's a little bit uneasy, and it makes it easier if you can see who's around.
No, definitely not. More street lighting would be more appropriate. Much more street lighting, yeah.
I don't think that will make a difference to safety, reducing the street lights, but it may feel people feel a little less safe. But I think in reality it won't actually affect people's safety.
That's a very good question. I don't know whether this sad event was anything to do with street lighting at all. I would separate those two questions, and I would hope that if they do that, then the streets will not be any more dangerous or any less safe than they are at present.
I think it's lighter is much better for us. Yes, yeah, so saving electricity is not, because having a better environment is good for the, good to increase the value of the city.
I think they ought to keep them on, to be honest with you. That's my opinion anyway. Keep it nice and light.
That's a good question. I think you should keep the lights on at night.
I think that's what they're for, isn't it? Most of them. Anyway, Martin, it might sound like a sort of trivial, silly question, but do you think it's possible that the fact that several lights were out and this was a very badly lit road contributed to...
as one of the respondents there suggested, this particular incident, it doesn't seem as if the streetlights would have made much of a difference one way or the other, because it seems to me that somebody had access to her flat. But, I mean, again, I'm speculating... in a general sense, I think keeping streetlights on is important for people's perception of safety. And I think that what may happen, for example, if the cuts do lead to street lamps not being on and then somebody is attacked and perhaps killed, then people will start to get angry and upset about that.
I mean, what's happening increasingly, it seems, that the City Council and many other authorities across the country are simply leaving streetlights, not replacing bulbs when they go out, and waiting for local residents to complain.
Also, the Police Federation this week was saying that they may organise demonstrations against the cuts because they're going to lose huge numbers of staff, frontline staff. Now... I think that the government going into the new year are going to find it quite difficult if they've got a situation where the police and others are saying that your policy is wrong. I think people are going to... We haven't actually had any cuts yet and the economy is already faltering. By the end of the year, I think the economy really will have blown out. I think that the government's policy will be in ruins and we'll have to have a change of direction. But at the moment, we're just seeing the storm clouds gathering, as we were talking about the people using credit cards to pay their mortgages and so on. These are all straws in the wind for where we're going. And I think when it happens, it's going to shock people, because we haven't had a crash yet. The government stepped in 2008 and prevented a crash. This time, they're not going to find it possible to do that in the same kind of way, and it's quite likely that there will therefore be a catastrophic crash, which will create all kinds of problems. The potential for this is something that people really need to think about, because I don't think there is a plan B. What we saw was, for example, when the Irish problem started to emerge last week, a couple of months ago, the government made $7.5 billion available to bail out Ireland, which is essentially bailing out the British banking system. Now, that is just for starters. There's going to be a general election in Ireland in the new year, and when that general election takes place, it's quite possible that the Irish will turn around and certainly renegotiate, if not repudiate, their debt. That will mean a big hit on the City of London, which is exposed to up to $200 billion to the Irish national debt. Now, that means that there's a whole potential for the British government to then be on the hook for bailing out the banks, for bailing out who will be knocked by the Irish refusing to pay their debt. And, of course, we've still got Spain, Portugal, Greece to come. Effectively, what we may see happening is that the government hasn't got a plan B for this storm that's coming around the corner. They just presume everything will somehow work because capitalism somehow works. What they didn't realise when they took power was that it's broke and they've got to have a plan B, a plan C and a plan D.
Thanks, Martin. Well, we're now joined by Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. Welcome to Drive Time, Jenny.
Welcome.
Now, what was your portfolio when Labour were running the city?
Social services and health.
Okay, now, why so friendly with the Tories on parks, for example, here in Bristol, but not in Westminster?
Well, I don't choose who you go in agreement with, other than the fact that we are very, very concerned that a lot of the parks are beneficial to communities, are loved by communities, and although we need housing, I do think that has gone through is completely unstructured, not thought through. In my own ward, we found we had clinical waste being put into one of the parks at the time when the city were really concerned about radioactive material going into the ground in various holes throughout the city. We want to know whether this was one of the areas where it was dumped. I've also got another piece of land where in the old estate. It's the only piece of ground for places like Colford and Lydney and Charfield children to play in. It's the area which is in the top 8% of poverty areas in the country. The children have played there. They dam the stream. They do all the things that some of us older people did when we were children. And suddenly the city council wants to sell it. It's also a floodplain. And at times when the sewers come up, we get raw sewage running through because the capacity of sewers in parts of this city cannot cope.
Now, Gary Hopkins would say what they've done really is just to make sure it's very, very clear to everybody which pieces of land are earmarked to be sold over the next 20 years or so. That is actually quite a responsible thing to do, because previously the Labour administration had been just selling little bits of land off willy-nilly.
We've still got lots of bits of land, backlands in Southmead that could be used. They keep constantly telling us about garage sites throughout the city, and yet those have been taken up in Southmead. I've got an old scout hut area that's hidden behind the houses. We have got other bits of land, and the community are telling everybody so. So I think what we need is someone to sensibly look at what's happening and also encompass all the bits of land that could be available, not just people's parks.
Now, I know you were at a housing meeting yesterday, so we're going to talk about housing. Bristol City Council's former specialist homeless advice centre, The Hub, on Cumberland Street off Brunswick Square, has been slowly run down over the last 2 years, and now it's closed. It's been merged with the General Council Inquiry Point at Phoenix Court opposite Cabot Circus. Well, we have an exclusive tonight, and that is to let you know that the former Homeless Advice Centre has been taken over by about 10 homeless people who are living there now. I visited them and spoke to two of the squatters, Jim and Eric.
I'm Jim. I'm here in this building. I was homeless and was introduced to some squatters. Collectively, I think it's between 7 and 10. We ended up in this building here.
I mean, this is actually designed as an office. How on earth can it be somewhere where you can comfortably live?
It's got a roof, it's heatable, it's got water, that's what else do you need to live? Yeah, I've only been squatting for a couple of months now. I've only been in one squat before this.
So what would you say, because some people would say, well, squatting is really actually very insecure and maybe you can only be there for a few weeks or a few months and then you have to move again.
As far as I can tell, you do get some situations where it can be quite a lengthy stay indeed. I think some of it is also how you go about it with the owners of the building and etc. You know, I mean, if you can open up communication and make some sort of arrangement, then it can become quite civil and you could be there for a long time.
But don't you want your own space? Because here you're living with maybe 10, 12 other people.
But, I mean, you have your own space. In the rooms, you've got divided areas for, you know, bedrooms and personal space. So, I mean, you get your own space. It's communal living. You have communal living in universities and all sorts of places. It's just the same, really, as far as your own space goes. We're lacking a couple of things, but the nice thing about squatting circles is everyone helps each other. So, I mean, someone else with one facility will help us out and we'll help them with something that they need.
Don't you think you should be paying rent for the place that you're staying?
If we weren't in this building, this perfectly acceptable building to live in would be empty, and the 7 to 10 people in here would potentially be out on the street. Does that make the landowner feel guilty at all by letting it sit here empty?
My name's Eric, and we run the Smiley Chair Bookshop, which is open on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, 2 till 6. And we're just there as a non-profit. Well, it's a squat, but it's non-profit. And we just try to inform people of some of the issues, like the economy, how it possibly could be collapsing. And there's lots of other little collectives meet there as well.
Can you tell us where it is then, and when it's open again?
It's on Stokes Croft. It's opposite the Emporium and Free Shop. It's open Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays, 2 till 6.
Okay, so that was Eric there, and before that, before him, Jim, who I met at the old Bristol Hub, which was the Homelessness
What's
Advice Centre.
What's significant about this is we're going back in time. We had, during the 80s and 90s, and I know that because I worked for Shelter, homeless people absolutely destitute, without anywhere to live or go, without jobs, without food, and they died. And I know that because a friend of mine wrote a book called Sick to Death of Homelessness, and they analysed what was coming up in the mortuaries. What's really worrying is Shelter on the last quarter has announced that there's been a 17% rise in homelessness, and every quarter this year there has been a rise, which means that we have increasing numbers of people in desperate situations. You can complain about them squatting, but anywhere will do when you have nothing left. And we had a welfare state that had housing law, which significantly addressed homelessness. And this government are about to change that. I went to a meeting last night of the housing management, and they are proposing a 7.5% increase in council rents in the city. And I pointed out that the reason it's going up is this Conservative Liberal government are actually saying that they've got to go up to the same rate as housing associations, so that council tenants in the city and throughout the southwest will have increased rents in order to catch up with the housing association tenancies.
Well, this is surely the reason for this is simply because the country's bankrupt. It can't afford to look after homeless people anymore.
I don't accept that the country is bankrupt. I do accept that we should clear some of the debt, but extremely slowly, and to plan ahead by taking away people's jobs, by taking away people's homes, by destroying the welfare state that have been built up over time. We are actually going to go into deep recessions which will affect the generations to come. I don't think that the people currently in Parliament really understand how ordinary people have to live and how most of our lives it's a struggle. And I know that my leaders and the rest of the Labour Party feel the same.
Are you talking about up in Westminster or here in Bristol?
No, I feel in Westminster, but here in Bristol you also have a Liberal Democrat controlled council which is split. Some of them would make very good Tories, and some would make possibly some wishy-washy Labour, but they do not actually constructively have ethics and principles like the rest of us have cherished.
Well, it's easy for you to say that, but the Labour Party has been in power up until last year, and since, was it something like 15 years since 97? You know, and you're now saying that, the Labour Party's got all these ethics and principles. Well, why weren't they kicking in?
We provided low-rent housing for people. We provided a decent allowances to enable children, elderly and the unemployed to survive without starving. All of this is being destroyed by this current administration. And we local authority members, certainly the ones that are in my party, are really worried about what's going to happen to future generations in this city and in the country.
Because I think many voters out there, Jenny, are thinking to themselves, well, hang on a minute, actually it doesn't really make a lot of difference who I vote for, because the whole new Labour thing up at Westminster, and they hold most of the cards up there, was very, very similar to the other parties. There's not really that much difference between the main parties.
No, there were differences. There was national minimum wages. There were all sorts of differences in policies. I mean, it wasn't brilliant, but it was an effort to try to ensure that people could maintain a life where they felt it was secure. That's not going to exist in the future.
So have you seen a difference in the way that the City Council deals with homelessness since the Liberal Democrats took over a few years ago?
Yes. Many people are now going into either hostels or into bed and breakfast. Many people, I've got cases in my ward where they're sleeping on people's settees because they're not counted as homeless, where overcrowding is starting to happen in the accommodation, where families are desperately trying to look after other members of the family, but it's overcrowded conditions with the stresses that come with that.
And one of the other things,
already there.
One of the things I keep hearing is that there is no night shelter in Bristol for women.
No,
and that there desperately
I know
that, needs to
yes.
be. Well, it Jenny, it was short but sweet. Thanks very much. That was Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith, chatting with Martin Summers and me. And after the news, we have more, which is Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance. Plus, we'll be hearing from John Loftus, former federal prosecutor, about his Nazi hunting activities.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody